This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, They shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by a front, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the resistance has gone from rocks to rockets, and it's obviously very much alive. This is despite the massive propaganda campaign saying that the resistance is fragmented and dissipating. Just on Monday, both the Palestinian resistance and the Yemeni armed forces hit the Zionist regime and its backers. The Palestinian resistance fired rockets from the most destroyed and repressed region of Gaza, where Zionist soldiers are even present in the north. And despite all of this, one rocket was able to hit Ashkelon. And on the same day, the Yemenis engaged in three successful operations against the Israeli regime and its U.S. cohort. Is the best still to come for the resistance? Well, stay with us as we take a look at all of this on this Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to this program. Saad Nemr, a professor of political science, Birzeit University, out of Ramallah. And Ali Rizk, security and political analyst, out of Beirut. Well, thank you both for being with us. I'm going to start this off in Ramallah. And Professor Nemr, we saw after the assassination of several resistance leaders, as well as the fall of Syria, with many corporate media outlets saying that the resistance is finished. Your thoughts on this?
Apparently, the Israelis failing in achieving anything in Lebanon, failing in achieving anything in Gaza, failing also to intercept the rockets coming from Yemen, they want to create a kind of a victory. Well, and this victory, they say that depending on the assassination that happened in Lebanon and the Beirut issue and then the martyrdom of Sinwar, Bahar and Haniyeh in Iran, all of these kind of things, they consider it as a big victory for them. And consequently, they started to, you know, promote these kind of ideas into the Israeli public, as well as to those who are supporting them, that Israel is in the best situation, because from the very beginning, Israel wanted to regain its power in the region as the number one army in the region. And it was humiliated in Lebanon and humiliated also in Gaza after 14 months now, and they couldn't achieve even one of their aims in Gaza. They destroyed all of Gaza, yet the resistance are still there. So this is only a kind of a publicity done by the Israelis in order to show a kind of you know, victory somehow, and they are talking about, you know, the fragmentation of the access of the resistance. They are talking about the weakness of the resistance in all of the region, which is absolutely not true. Okay. Hezbollah agreed to stop the war last month, but at the same time, they are regaining their power and they are willing even to continue if the Israelis continue with their atrocities. Yemen, they can't do anything, and they admit that they have no cure to what's going on in Yemen. In Gaza, as you mentioned, 300 meters where the Israeli soldiers, where the rockets were launched in Jabalia, north of Gaza.
All right. Well, Ali, let's look at Hezbollah, because as Hezbollah Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem says that the organization has regrouped after the pager and walkie-talkie terrorist attacks, along with the assassination of its top leaders, and is fully prepared now for all scenarios. Your thoughts on this?
Well, I think that Hezbollah was subject to unprecedented, there's no doubt about it, unprecedented heavy blows during the latest war which took place. But it was able to regroup to some extent. It wasn't outright defeated. I think that we can't say it was defeated. I think, again, it was maybe in a state of down but not out. I think that given the magnitude or the size of the Hezbollah organization, I think it's very difficult to deal at an outright defeat. That's not to mention the ideological dimension, I think, which is also very important. And in the end, I think it's ideology and doctrine which will keep such movements alive in the resistance axis. However many you kill, however many leaders you kill, as long as you have that ideology which is there, there will be other people who will come and replace and fill in the ranks. And I even think that, interestingly, if you look at the assassination of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, in particular, the former Secretary General, I think that in the long run, that might not have been a very wise Israeli decision. And what I mean by that is that many people, because of the immense passion a lot of people had for Sayyid Hassan and his immense popularity, a lot of those who supported him and supported Hezbollah but were not necessarily members of Hezbollah, I think now will be mobilized to actually become members of the movement. And so in the long run, this could end up swelling Hezbollah's ranks.
Interesting point. And especially, I want to pick up on what Ali just said, Saad, when he talked about, for example, how with the martyrdom of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, that it actually has caused many others who perhaps weren't members of Hezbollah to become members. I mean, let's look at that, because part of it is the lack of humanity, the way the regime, we won't even say fight its wars, because these are just terrorist acts. For example, with Sayyid Hassan, the amount of incendiary devices that were used. I mean, isn't that part of it all? And the reaction from the resistance is the overall lack of humanity that the regime possesses.
Yes, absolutely. You are absolutely right. But let me just first comment on what your guest just mentioned. I do agree absolutely with him that more and more people are, you know, joining because of that. We have the same thing happened not only in Gaza, but also in the West Bank after the martyrdom of Sinwar. Sinwar's story when he was, you know, in that building, and even when he finished with his ammunition, he would stick quick he was trying to continue his resistance. And that inspired a lot of people. And his martyrdom was a kind of a, you know, legendary for the Palestinians. And that will make the Palestinian even more insisting on resisting the occupation. This is absolutely right. On the other side, when we are talking about, you know, the Israeli, they have no targets, real targets or bank of targets, as they say, whether it's in Gaza or later on in Lebanon. And they start only hitting the civilians, the hospitals, aid workers and journalists. We are talking about more than 200 journalists in Gaza were killed during this campaign. So we are talking here about lack of humanity. Totally lack of humanity. And now, apparently, nowadays, the Israeli society started to think about it, especially after the two or three incidents happening in some countries around the world to arrest some of the soldiers. One of them in Brasilia, he ran away, but another one in Thailand, he was caught. So now they started to think that you pushed us with this long war to be inhumane. That's what the people are saying, and especially mothers of the soldiers. You are pushing our children to be more inhumane. So, yeah, we have two stories, or we have two pictures here. One of this inhumanity and aggression and genocidal war against the Palestinians, against the Lebanese, and against everyone in the region. And on the other hand, you have the ethical and kind of values and ideology, as your guest mentioned, and all these kind of things which prevent people of doing such a thing. And we can compare, for instance, between the situation of the prisoners, Israeli prisoners captive by the Palestinian resistance, and the Palestinian prisoners in the Israeli prisons. They treated them according to their ethics, according to their values. The Israeli doing the same. They are dealing with our prisoners in the same way, their ethics and values, which is absolutely inhumane.
Yes, indeed. Well, Ali, the Yemeni resistance continues to exert major pressure on the Zionist regime as well as its supporters. Let's talk about how is this happening, really. And do you think that the U.S. and its supporters, of course, the Zionist regime, have been surprised by the success of the Yemenis?
Before I answer the question, just a quick comment about ideology. I think that when you look at the Israeli government, it's well known now, it's a common fact that it's the most right-wing fascist Israeli government ever to have come into existence. So I believe that when you have such an extreme fascist ideology, that's going to lead to an extreme and more firm ideological commitment on the opposing side. So I think that the ideology of the axis of resistance is only going to increase. And I think that with the rise of the right wing, the far right extremist Israelis, I think that the parties that are labeled as moderate Arabs, they'll be losing the argument to those more committed to the axis of resistance, because when you're up against such fascist entities, I think it becomes clear, more clear than ever, that negotiations don't work. Regarding your question about the Yemenis, I think that there was an element of surprise. I think that the Americans and the Israelis were surprised. But I think more importantly than that, I think they're at loss as to how to deal with the Houthis or with Ansar Allah. Ansar Allah, it's the geographical distance poses somewhat of a challenge for Israel, a challenge it doesn't confront when you look at Gaza or Lebanon. And so when it comes to Yemen, the Israelis have to rely more on the Americans. And that poses the question, how much are the Americans, how far are they willing to go in order to enter into some kind of a war against Ansar Allah? I know they have launched some military attacks, some escalated attacks, but I think that the Americans will only be willing to go so far in the war against Ansar Allah, not least because many of the Persian Gulf Arab allies like Saudi Arabia and the UAE are fearful of how that could unfold and how that could lead to the resumption of attacks on these countries themselves, which are Western allies. So Ansar Allah, indeed, it does pose a real predicament, whether it be for the Israelis or even for the Americans.
Right, interesting point. Well, Saad, going back to the Yemenis, I mean, the U.S. has recently tried to do whatever it could to get the Yemenis to stop its support for the Palestinians, even to the point of promising them funds from tariffs to be taken in the Red Sea. But the Yemenis not only refused, but we saw yesterday they initiated several operations. I mean, isn't a main part of this issue, whether we're talking about the Zionists or the total Western hegemonic front, is a lack of understanding about ideals and goals that they think, for example, that the Yemenis have been standing up for the Palestinians, that they could bribe them now with money and that they would step away from their ideals?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And the Americans and all the imperialists and all other countries, capitalism, they are thinking in this way, that we can, you know, offer always the offer of the carrot or the stick. And they tried the stick, it didn't work with them, and they also are offering, you know, the carrot. And the carrot in this case, and to lift all the embargoes on Yemen, and to give them aids, and to help them, and all these kind of, you know, things that usually the American would offer, or the Western countries would offer. But definitely they don't understand, they miss the point that Yemenis are not about, you know, their interest, and they are not looking for some money here and there. They are really committed to the ideas. They are really committed to help the Palestinians. They are really committed to the idea of ending this entity called Israel, which is absolutely out of place in our region. And they can do that. And this is why should they stop? Money is not an issue for the Yemenis. They've been under war for 8 years from Saudi Arabia and AUE, and it was orchestrated by the Americans at that time and the Western countries. Now we have the Americans and the United Kingdom in the Red Sea, and they are trying also to attack every when and while Yemen, but they do know that it's a failure. They can't do anything to Yemen. So the idea of the stick is absolutely not going to be there. And as your guest also mentioned, the geography distance between Israel and Yemen make it very, very complicated for the Israeli even to do the hits. The hits that they did, you know, few weeks ago on some of civilian instructions in Yemen, it was, you know, really very complicated, according even to the Israeli media. They have these aeroplanes with also provided with another aeroplanes to protect them, and they have also those aeroplanes who had to supply them with fuel on the long distance. So it is a very complicated to send 10 or 15 aeroplanes to hit a target in Yemen. You need more than 100, you know, aeroplanes in here and there. So it's very, very complicated. They do know that. And the other thing is, they admit that they have lack of information. They have no intel on what's going on in Yemen. The leaders, the whereabout of the rockets, the factories, and everything about Yemen is absolutely, like, you know, in blank. They have no idea what's going on there. They were focusing more on Syria, on Iraq, on Lebanon, on West Bank and Gaza during the period, on Jordan, on Egypt, but they didn't think at all that Yemen will be in such a situation that it harmed them really very badly.
Hmm. I want to pick up on something, Ali, that you talked about when you said about basically when we look at the overall situation. Well, let me go to something actually. When we look at the axis of resistance, I want to quote what the Iranian foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, he says that the school of resistance continues to grow despite challenges and many ups and downs throughout the West Asia region. And he also talked about the strength of the resistance, that you cannot dismantle the resistance because the strength lies in the blood of the martyrs. I want to talk about this. And when we look at, for example, Let's look at the leaders that have been martyred. We look at, for example, Ismail Haniyeh, and we know prior to his martyrdom, the campaign, the propaganda campaign that they had said, and of course, prior to him being martyred, his children, some of his children, his grandchildren, and of course, let's look at Yahya Sinwar, the way that what they were saying, and then reality, when he became a martyr, he hadn't eaten in several days, and he's out there with the people. Sayyid Hassan, they're there with the people. The difference between this type of leadership and dealing with the Zionists and the Americans is a very, very stark difference. How much of that plays into all of this, Ali?
I think indeed that the leadership plays a very important role, and the school of thought. In the end, you know, this is a resistance school of thought. And it could be compared to many leaders throughout history. If you look at people like Nelson Mandela or Mahatma Gandhi, you're talking about struggles which in the end inevitably prevail, despite the difficulties, despite the odds. I think that the oppressed, in the end, they overcome or defeat the oppressors. And I think that is the road Israel is heading on, or it's the road it's taking. Now, with Israel, I think what's made it last so long is the fact that it enjoys American support. If you look at South Africa during the apartheid regime, it was supported by America, but not this much. South Africa, apartheid didn't have such a very strong lobby, for example, in America like the Israelis do. So that's what's enabled, I think, Israel to last as much as it had. But again, here I think that the situation doesn't necessarily favor the Israelis. I think that the Americans have more important duties or priorities to attend to, first and foremost China. And by the way, Donald Trump's remarks about the Panama Canal and Greenland and other territories, a lot of this is directed towards China. I was reading a very interesting article just before the start of this interview. A lot of it is related to trying to contain the Chinese. So that's where the American geostrategic priorities lie. Mm. And I think it's only a matter of time before the Americans are no longer going to have any more time left to attend to the Israelis the way they do. And if Netanyahu continues to pursue the ideological approach he's doing in a way which often undermines even U.S. interests, I think that does carry with it the danger of leading to some real divisions or divergence between the United States and Israel.
Hmm. Well, Saeed, Hamas official Osama Hamdan, he has outlined the movement's stance on these ceasefire negotiations, emphasizing the urgency of a ceasefire, the IOF's withdrawal from Gaza, prisoner exchange, and unconditional rebuilding efforts. Your thoughts, do you think that a ceasefire is near, and do you see the regime actually withdrawing from Gaza?
Well, we have two issues here. The first one is that ceasefire, yes, it's going to be, and even, you know, either with or a little bit before Trump moving to the White House. This is something, you know, because Trump wanted that, and apparently Netanyahu wanted to give it as to Trump as a gift for him, and that's why even the staff of Trump is already involved in these also negotiations, in addition to the Biden administration. So this is a ceasefire for 60 days maybe, or 42 days, whatever the deal is. But that's what exactly Netanyahu wanted, to say that we didn't stop the war. And this is to keep his coalition in the government, because his coalition, they were against the stop the war and to end the war, and they wanted to continue. So now he's saying that this is a truce. This is a kind of a, you know, a ceasefire. Only for 60 days, we will get some of our prisoners out, and we will give them something, you know, like some aid and food. Now, the main issue here, which Hamas was very clever in dealing with the negotiations from the very beginning, they agreed And they gave some concession on the issue of to have this deal on three stages. The first stage, it will be ceasefire. The Israel will continue to stay there, but with some other, you know, details, like, you know, people start moving back to the north, though there is, you know, the Israeli soldiers are there, but at least, you know, they can move back to north of Gaza, bringing in, opening the crossings and bringing in the aid and food and starting some of, you know, aiding the Palestinians, especially in reconstruction of at least hospitals or things like that, which is very necessary now for the Palestinians. And then there is the exchange of prisoners. Now, in the second stage, now Hamas is saying at this stage, within these 60 days, the first 60 days, there should be a declaration from Israel to stop the war after that and to withdraw all its troops out of Gaza. Otherwise, there will be no more exchange and we will keep the prisoners. So Israel now under pressure in this one. And the third stage, it will be the releasing of the bodies of the dead or deceased soldiers by the Israeli soldiers captive by Hamas, or the one who even died under the Israeli atrocities against Gaza. So they agreed to have it on par. And because of this agreement, now Netanyahu have no other excuses to his public or to the government or to anyone else not to go ahead with the deal. And especially that, as your guest mentioned, Trump now have two main issues. He don't want to look at the Middle East. He's interested now for the file of China and the file of the Ukraine-Russia war. These are the main subjects for him now, and he don't want to go into small details in Gaza.
That note, I thank both of you for being with us, but we're out of time. Saad Nim, Professor of Political Science, Beirut University out of Ramallah. Ali Idris, Security and Political Analyst out of Beirut. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of God, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful, and may great peace and blessing be upon Prophet Muhammad and his household. Assalamu alaikum, my dear audience, brothers and sisters, and welcome to the series of talks for humanity. This is Hamza Azizi. In previous episodes, we began to talk about a new type of support for every member of the Islamic Ummah and believer society, which we named it as spiritual support. You can name it as emotional support as well. By the way, we ended the previous episode with this first example of spiritual support, which was learning or teaching support. We mentioned that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala establishes a code and a new formula, a new ruling in His holy book, that everyone who learns a good thing, he has this responsibility to teach to the others. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in chapter Tawbah quotes the very general ruling of this issue. He says that in a society, there must be a group of people who takes this responsibility to travel, to go and try and attempt to learn good things from Prophet or other divine sources. And then they return to their own people, and then they teach to the others who have not traveled, who have not attempted such effort. They have to teach them what they have learned. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that it is correct that not everyone is able to travel or to go for learning divine statements or for learning revelation, what Prophet teaches to the other people, to the Muslims. But it is correct that not all of you can go, but at least some of you can go to the Prophet and ask and learn and give and receive the proper knowledge and take this proper knowledge to their own people when they return to their own cities. So this is a responsibility. فَلَوْلَا نَفَرَ مِنْ كُلِّ فِرْقَةٍ مِنْهُمْ طَائِفَةٌ لِيَتَفَقَّهُ فِي الدِّينِ. Why should not there go forth a group from each of their sections to become learned, educated in religion? وَلْيُنْذِرُوا قَوْمَهُمْ. They have to warn their own people when إِذَا رَجَعُوا إِلَيْهِمْ, when they return to them. This is a responsibility. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala takes this as a general, overall responsibility for all Muslims. So teaching support is a responsibility for every mu'min, every believer in a society. Of course, there is a question arises here that, okay, what kind of knowledge is the proper knowledge? What kind of knowledge? Of course, that is not our concern and our point of concern at this point. I remember that once we've been talking about knowledge and the significance of knowledge in long previous episodes, we talked about proper knowledge, but whatever thing that is beneficial for believers, for society, practically or religiously, that is a proper knowledge. So we have this responsibility to teach to the others. This is the first example of support. Inshallah, after a short break, we will come back and we will go to the other examples. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad ya muslimi sallu alayhi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad sallu alayhi ya mu'mini sallu alayhi. Welcome back, my dear audience, brothers and sisters, to the series of Talks for Humanity. This is Hamza Azizi. We've been talking about the examples of spiritual support that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala considers it as a responsibility and obligatory for all believers. The second example of spiritual support is keeping secrets. This is very significant. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in different occasions in His holy book, apart from the emphasis that the Prophet and infallible imams have put on this issue, in the holy book, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in different occasions, emphasized that all believers have to keep the secrets of the individual members and the secret of the whole Islamic Ummah. And this latter is much more important than the former. Not only we are responsible to take the secrets, to keep the secrets of individuals in an Islamic Ummah, but also we are obliged to keep and maintain and save the secrets of the whole Ummah. And that is very important. Chapter Ali Imran, verse 118, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, la tattakhidhu bitanatan min dunikum, la ya'lunakum khabala. O you the believers, you have the people who you have faith, do not take your confidence, your friends, from others than yourselves. It means from the out of the scope of the Islamic Ummah, out of the scope of the believers. They will spare nothing to ruin you. وَدُّوا مَا عَنِتُّمْ. They are eager to see you in distress. قَدْ بَدَتِ الْبَغْضَاءُ مِنْ أَفْوَاهِهِمْ. Hatred has already shown itself from their mouths. وَمَا تُخْفِي صُدُورُهُمْ أَكْبَرُ. And what their breasts, their hearts hide is yet worse. قَدْ بَيَّنَّا لَكُمُ الْآيَاتِ. We have certainly made the signs clear for you. We have elaborated completely for you that what is your responsibility? Your responsibility is to keep the secrets of the Islamic Ummah, as well as keeping the secret of every individual believers. If I have a friend and he feels confident to share his own secret with me, I do not have this right. I'm not allowed to share this with the others without his permission. And this is something that is very, unfortunately, common in our societies. We are not that much careful about the secrets of our friends, our family members, and we are not that much careful about the secrets of the whole ummah. And nowadays, in modern time, that these social networks are very common and spread among the people in the society, we feel the necessity of keeping this point much more than the previous times. You see, when I have a secret, and by secret I mean that something that is not going to be known by all people in the society, my friend has seen me as his own close friend to share it with me. I'm not allowed to share it, no matter it is a piece of information or a picture or something else. So this is something that we have to take care about that. The third example is very much connected to this one. Inshallah, in the next episode, we will elaborate that. Thank you. Have a good time. Walhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen.
Jannah, Jannah, it's all I ever wish for. This life is not eternal, but the next will last forever.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.com. www.ssmic.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Recent reports have revealed that the Israeli regime now controls 40% of water resources shared by Syria and Jordan. This is part of Israel's broader expansion in Syrian territories, sparking condemnation from both Damascus and Amman. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website Observer Diplomat has covered this story and tells us more. For years, the Israeli regime coveted Syria's abundant water resources, particularly in the country's southern regions, to mitigate its own chronic water shortages. After a dramatic fall of Bashar al-Assad's government in Damascus recently, the Israeli regime unleashed an aggressive and unprecedented military assault on Syria with multiple strategic objectives. The Zionist military forces swiftly expanded beyond the occupied Golan Heights, seizing the buffer zone and Mount Hermon, a pivotal peak that straddles the borders of Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine. Yet this incursion was only the beginning. On Thursday, 2nd of January, Syrian media reported that Israeli occupation forces captured the Al-Mantara Dam, the lifeline for Syrian Army's 90th Brigade in Sassa near Damascus, as a cover-up for their latest theft. Located just a few hundred metres east of Quneitra, some 50 kilometres southwest of the Syrian capital Damascus, Al-Mantara Dam sits within the buffer zone established on the Golan Heights in 1979. This vital water reservoir has for long sustained not only Quneitra province, where the occupied Golan Heights is located, but also the broader arid southern region of Syria. With the occupation of Al-Mantara Dam, the most significant dam in southern Syria, experts say nearly 40% of Syria's water resources are now under Israel's illegal control. Before Al-Mantara, they occupied five other key sites that supply water to Syria from neighbouring countries. The city of Quneitra and its surrounding areas fell to Israeli military forces in December, just days after former President Bashar al-Assad's government collapsed and Western-backed militants led by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham seized control of Syria. In rapid succession, the Tel Aviv regime occupied 266 square kilometres of buffer zone territory, flagrantly violating the 1974 agreement on disengagement. Israeli occupation forces then pushed further east, confiscating additional Syrian territory illegally. The occupation zone now stretches from the eastern slopes of Mount Hermon on the Lebanese border to the Yarmouk River Valley near Jordan in the south. After advancing into the region, Israeli troops established military checkpoints, erected earthen barriers, and imposed strict entry and exit controls, upending the daily lives of local residents. Angered by the disruptions to their lives, Syrians across occupied settlements staged widespread protests. Israeli military forces responded with live fire, further stoking tensions and outrage. The so-called safe zone narrative invoked grim memories of previous occupations in Lebanon, the Golan Heights and Palestine, territories that the Zionist regime dominated for decades and still seeks to annex and control. We continue with the website Observer Diplomat's coverage of this story. A closer look at the borders of the Israeli occupation zone in Syria reveals that the focus was capturing all the vital reservoirs and rivers in the occupied Golan Heights. In addition to the 3.5-kilometer-long Al-Mantara embankment dam located within the United Nations buffer zone, 9 other dams outside the zone were also captured, all in the Quneitra and Daraa provinces of Syria. The Israeli occupation army also occupied the smaller Rehina Dam, located 2.5 kilometers downstream on the same Rogad River, otherwise the natural border of the Golan Heights to the east. On the same river, another 10 kilometers downstream, there is the 3-kilometer-long Kudna Dam, occupied together with the nearby smaller Barika Dam. 2 other relatively larger occupied dams on the Rogad River are the Qadir al-Bustan Dam near the settlement of Zagbi and Nasiriyah, and the Jis Rogad Dam near Seda and Ain Zakar. The Rogad River, as one of the most important tributaries, flows downstream into the Yarmouk River, the natural border between Syria and Jordan, and the latter further into the strategically and water-bearing, equally important Jordan River. 3 other occupied dams located to the east on tributaries of the Rogad River are Shabrak Dam, Sahim al-Golan Dam, and Abedin Dam. The 10th occupied reservoir is Al-Wehda or Magarin Dam, a 110-meter-high concrete gravity dam on the Yarmouk River, on the border between Syria and Jordan. Joint Jordanian-Syrian plans for this dam have existed since the early 1950s, but it only opened up in 2011, the year Syria saw the eruption of foreign-backed militancy. The biggest opponent of the dam's construction was the Israeli regime, claiming that the reservoir would threaten the supply of the Jordan River, on which it depends for drinking water and has repeatedly gone to war with its neighbours over it. Besides these dams in the north of the occupied zone, next to Mount Hermon, the Israeli military has occupied the valley of the Awaj River, which together with the Barada River represents the key feeder of the basin of Damascus province. The English website of Al Mayadeen Television Network has also covered the same story. The Israeli occupation of Syrian reservoirs and rivers represents a significant blow to the authorities of Hay'at Tahrir al-Sham, considering that it is the latest in a series of foreign restrictions on water access. For the Tel Aviv regime, the occupation of Syrian water resources is not only a useful political tool for blackmailing the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham authorities in Damascus, but also a valuable natural resource that they do not have. Water resources have been a focus for the Zionist regime since before the establishment of the illegal entity in occupied Palestine and during successive wars against its Arab neighbors. Chaim Weizmann, one of the Zionist forefathers and Israel's first president at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, demanded that the boundaries of any future state should include the headwaters of the Jordan, Mount Hermon, and the lower reaches of the Litani River in Lebanon. According to Chaim Weizmann, the control of the Litani River, Jordan, and Yarmouk rivers, which was expressed in a letter to the British Prime Minister at the time, was very much central to the future of Zionist entity security. David Ben-Gurion, another key Zionist founder and Israel's first prime minister in 1948, similarly reiterated that the boundaries include the southern banks of the Litani River, but the League of Nations rejected these claims to Lebanese territory. The post-war consensus is that Lake Tiberias, the Jordan River, and the Litani River have been Israeli targets in numerous wars from 1948 to the present day, including last year's attempts to break out onto the banks of the latter Lebanese River. The Zionist regime today receives about 80% of its water supply through five key desalination plants located next to coastal power plants. However, these facilities are large in surface area and fragile in a potential conflict, especially with the ballistic missile strikes that could leave millions of Zionist settlers without access to water. Hence, the Israeli regime continues to resort to old plans to occupy foreign water-rich territories, which is being witnessed in Syria today. Abdul Malik al-Houthi, the leader of Yemen's Ansar Allah resistance movement, in his recent speech also pointed to the fact that Israel's aggression in Syria aims to control valuable water resources of the Syrian nation.